Martha waved behind her. Got chatting to some cleaners on a fag break. They used to clean Johnny's ward. Used to? So he's dead. Still alive, but he's been moved. Where? Royal Edinburgh, most likely. My dad signed the paperwork. When was this? A few weeks ago. Martha got into the car and Billy followed. Inside, Martha looked at him closely. I know I'm new to this reporting thing, but this is all pretty suspect, yeah?
Yeah.
Martha turned the engine on and revved. That's what I thought. She took a deep breath. I was just there as well.
Where?
The Royal. That's where I got the ECT this morning. It's the only psychiatric hospital in Edinburgh. Because Ian approved his release, Johnny would have been sent there. At least that's what my cleaning woman reckoned.
So what now?
We go to the Royal. Chapter 35. They'd just hit the bypass when Billy got a call. He pressed answer.
Hey, V, what's up?
Martha was dealing with chaotic traffic, rush hour where the M9 fed into the ring road, lane switching all over the place. She glanced over and saw Billy frown.
What is it? She said. Are we in trouble?
Billy held his hand up to her.
Okay, I'll tell her, he said down the phone, then hung up. He turned to her. Your phone's off.
I know.
Cal's been trying to call you for hours.
A taxi cut in front of them, making Martha swerve across the lanes. A Tesco lorry tooted at her.
Yeah, yeah, she said to the mirror, then to Billy. What does Cal want?
Eventually he called the office, spoke to V.
What is it, Billy? You're scaring me.
Don't flip out.
What?
It's your house.
Martha shuddered the car forward a few yards, easing into traffic. She frowned.
My house?
It's on fire. Chapter 36. They saw the smoke from about a mile away. Then closer, the smell. Acrid, poisonous, choking, even with the car windows up.
Come on,
Martha spoke to herself as she pushed her knuckles into her eye sockets. They were sitting at a red light at the Jewel, a few minutes away. She revved the engine.
Fucking Edinburgh traffic!
Billy touched the dashboard. Take it easy.
Don't tell me to take it easy, Martha said. My home's burning down.
Green light. She swerved to overtake a Volvo and Billy's touch on the dashboard became heavier.
Jesus, he said.
They turned, then turned again, Billy thrown about in the passenger seat. Then they were in Hamilton Terrace. Round the final corner into Hamilton Drive and Martha slammed on the brakes. Couldn't go any further. Three fire engines blocking the road. All three had hoses unreeled and were blasting water onto the house. Smoke was pummeling out the windows in a rush to escape, flames licking out like winking eyes. Part of the roof was already gone, collapsed from the heat. Flames and smoke danced out the holes. The windows were all gone, blown out or caved in. One fire engine had a guy up a ladder, spraying onto the roof. The second one was aiming at the upstairs. The final guy was blasting water in through the living room window frame. The three guys working the hoses were in full heat protection gear, arms and legs thick with padding, gas masks and helmets. Other firemen were busying themselves with checking the hoses, but a few were just standing around. Martha wondered what the hell they could be doing. Surely they should at least be making themselves look busy. A crowd had gathered. Martha recognised the old guy, Fergus, from number 19 with his dog, Betty. The dog was cowering behind his legs. She saw other neighbours, people she said hello to in the street, standing around transfixed by the blaze. She jumped out the car, then didn't know what to do. Run to the house? What for? She remembered sitting on the living room floor this morning, the gas fire on, the blanket wrapped round her. Had she turned the fire off? What about the blanket? Where were Elaine and Cal? She wanted to run in the opposite direction, through the park, find a quiet spot amongst the bushes, curl up and sleep forever. She stared at the smoke, trying to figure it out. The thick billows of black tapered as they stretched into the sky, twisting into sinewy strands, infecting the air around them. The smell of charred wood and brick and melting plastic and scorched glass filled her nose. She put a hand out to steady herself, touched the roof of the Mini. Cal's car. Where was Cal? She staggered towards the fire. She could sense Billy next to her, but she didn't turn and acknowledge him, didn't want to see the look on his face or the reflection of the flames in his eyes. She felt the ferocious heat now, making the skin on her face flush. Her eyes stung and her mouth and throat were dry, sandy. She tripped over the curb and righted herself. She got as far as Fergus, who touched her arm. Thank goodness you're safe. Martha was close enough now to feel the spray from the hoses. It was turning to steam as it hit the flames at the open windows. She could hear the water sizzling, mingled with the crackle and crunch of the fire, destroying her home. Fergus nodded beyond the first fire engine. Your mother has been worried sick. Martha followed his nod and saw Elaine staring at the house, arms wrapped around herself like she was cold. She couldn't be cold. The heat from the fire was overpowering. Elaine's face was radiant, lit up by the flames. Martha watched her for a moment, didn't want to break this spell. She would have to go over and speak to Elaine and acknowledge what was happening, and they would have to face up to the fact that their home and all their possessions were gone, disintegrating under the weight and heat of the fire, and the tons of water flooding into the rooms, battling the flames into submission. The longer she put that off, the longer she didn't speak to Elaine, the longer she could still pretend she had a home. Elaine turned and looked right at Martha, then ran over and put her arms around her. Oh, thank God, she said. She squeezed Martha tight. Martha felt the roughness of Elaine's jacket zip against her chin as she pressed her head into her mum's chest. We didn't know for sure, Elaine said. Cal said you had his car, that you'd gone somewhere, but there was still a chance you were inside. She let Martha go and they both turned to the house, warm spray on their faces, like having a shower. Where's Cal? Elaine didn't take her eyes off the flames. Talking to one of the fire officers. He spent ages trying to get hold of you. My phone was off, Martha said. Elaine took her hand, both of them still staring at the house. A section of roof cracked, then collapsed, sending a blast of heat around them. Elaine squeezed Martha's hand, and it felt like Martha was a little girl again. Where were you? Elaine said. Nowhere important. Chapter 37. They decamped to Fergus's house. After the initial surge of activity, the outsized firemen in clumpy boots, the flash of their lights, the searing heat and choking smoke of the fire, after all that, this was the dead zone. Cal and the fire officer had found Martha and Elaine holding hands. The officer suggested they might as well wait indoors, there was nothing they could do to help, and it could take several more hours to be completely sure that the fire was out. Then the forensic people had to go over the place, look for a cause. Martha didn't think about that. It felt like a betrayal to leave their home still burning in the street, like leaving a dying deer in the middle of the road and driving off. But now they were sitting drinking tea. Or rather, Martha was standing, staring out the window, her tea cold. Fergus came in with a tray of biscuits, bourbons and those pink wafer things. Martha thought the idea of biscuits was obscene. This whole situation was obscene. She couldn't see their house from here, but she could see the fire engines, the firefighters, a handful of neighbours still out there, though they were dispersing. And she could see smoke and spray, their home's death rattle. I can't stay here, she said. There's nothing we can do out there, Cal said. Tea and biscuits, though, Martha said. Fergus lifted up the tray, not realising she was being sarcastic. Martha shook her head, as much at herself as him. Elaine was on the sofa, mug of tea clutched in her lap, head down. She lifted her head and seemed to see the room for the first time. She looked at Billy. Who are you?
I'm Billy, a colleague of Martha's.
At the paper?
Yeah.
Were you with her today?
Yeah.
Why was her phone off?
Martha turned.
It just was.
Elaine frowned.
I thought you were having the day off after the treatment.
Martha rubbed at her temple.
I got bored. Anyway, I wasn't actually at work.
Where were you?
Martha thought for a moment.
Not a good time to bring this up, but when was it ever going to be?
Me and Billy were at Carstairs.
Elaine looked confused.
The mental home?
The state hospital.
What?
It's what they call the place now, but yeah, the mental prison.
Elaine still gripped her mug in her lap.
Why were you there? I thought you wrote obituaries.
It wasn't work. I was looking for someone.
Johnny Lamb.
Martha watched Elaine closely, looking for something. A reaction, like a cheap soap actor. Elaine stared at the wisps of steam curling up from her mug.
Does that name mean anything to you? Martha said.
Elaine stared out the window. Two firemen clumped past.
Should it?
Yes, it fucking well should, Martha said.
Cal turned.
Calm down, sis.
I will not calm down.
Martha turned back to Elaine.
Is there something you want to tell us?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Johnny Lamb, our dad's brother, our uncle, who we've never heard about until now?
Elaine was still staring out at the fire engines, face blank.
Maybe now's not the time, Billy said.
Fuck that,
Martha said. Fergus was cowering in the doorway, Betty behind his legs.
Martha, Cal said, Billy's right, now's not the time.
Then when is the time, Cal? It seems there hasn't been a right time to mention this in the last 20 years. Don't you find that a little fucking strange? Don't you find it just the tiniest bit weird that our mother never once, in 2 decades, felt the need to tell us we had an uncle in a psychiatric prison?
Elaine put her mug down on the coffee table and got up.
I can't talk about this right now.
She walked towards the door.
Wait,
Martha said.
No,
Elaine said.
She had tears in her eyes as she turned.
I'm going to see if there's any of our home left. We have to talk about this,
Martha shouted after her, but Elaine was already at the doorway, Fergus shuffling sideways to let her past. Elaine walked out the front door and over to the guy in charge of the first fire engine.
What the fuck?
Martha said. Cal sighed.
It's been 20 years. It can wait a few more hours, no?
Martha turned to him, her eyes wet.
He's not in Carstairs anymore, she said. He was transferred to the Royal recently. Dad signed for him.
Shit, Cal said. Martha gazed out the window. Elaine was gesticulating with the fire officer. Martha thought about the gas fire, the blanket. Someone had mentioned forensic officers. She tried to remember. Short-term memory loss. The ECT. A long-lost brother no one talked about. She felt the crushing weight of it all and reached out to touch the glass of the window. It felt cold, and she couldn't imagine the heat just a few yards away, destroying 20 years of her life. Chapter 38. Martha was raging drunk. She sat in the middle of the room surrounded by the mess she'd made. She'd spent the last 2 hours rummaging through the contents of Ian's flat, turning out drawers, emptying shelves, frantically raking through piles of crap, looking for answers. Cal and Billy couldn't talk to her. She knew she was being stupid, irrational. She sucked in a bottle of gin they'd found in the back of a cupboard, winced, made a face. Who the hell still drank gin in this day and age? It deserved to die in the 20th century, along with all this other old crap. What struck her now about Ian's stuff was how dated it all was. That he was set in his ways might have been expected, but a Walkman still being used in 2014? Really? She'd seen a cassette player like his, a yellow version instead of red, on a school trip to the Museum of Scotland round the corner. A fucking museum!
That's where Ian and his mysterious brother belonged, dead and stuffed, on display in some dusty glass case down the end of a disused corridor in a museum no fucker ever visited anymore. But that wasn't true either, because Johnny was still alive, still in the land of the living, very much still with us. At least, she thought he was. It had been too late to make inquiries at the Royal after the whole business with the house. She'd phoned and tried to use her insider knowledge as an outpatient, but she got nowhere with a night shift nurse and was told to call back in the morning when someone would be able to help. Elaine had gone to a neighbour's house, Barbara at number 11. Martha couldn't remember Elaine ever mentioning Barbara before, let alone being best mates. By the time the sun had dropped behind Arthur's Seat, the fire at their home was under control. What was left was a soggy skeleton of brick and rafters, gallons of black water pouring out into the gutter and taking their family history with it. Nothing to be done until morning. Martha and Cal had turned down the offer of a bed at Barbara's and had ended up here at Ian's flat. Might as well make use of the place, since they had nowhere to call home now. As soon as they came through the door, Martha began turning the place upside down, looking for answers, for some confirmation that this Johnny character existed, that he was in the world, breathing and speaking and shitting and pissing. She tried to speak to Elaine again. Nothing. A brick wall. That annoyed her more than anything, her mother using the shock of the fire to avoid talking about the past. The fire. Forensics. Christ. She drank furiously as she threw clothes, papers and other crap around. Cal and Billy tried to calm her, but everything they said made her more angry. Why did no one else take this shit seriously? She remembered the notebook of Ian she'd taken that second night here in the flat. She pictured reading it in front of the fire in her living room. The room that was now a blackened shell. She pulled the notebook out of her bag and rubbed at the cover with her thumb, thinking of Ian's hands touching it. It was all her fault. She tried to think positively, tried to picture the reboot of her mind this morning, resetting the synapses. It had lifted the weight from her, but everything else, all of life, had swamped back in and suffocated her. Johnny Lamb. Johnny fucking Lamb. She swigged more gin, made the face again. Her eyes were unfocused, her brain more so. Cal and Billy sat quietly on the sofa, watching her. Johnny Lamb, why are you such a fucking secret? Gig number 3, the 4th of the 6th, 92. She sat alone in the Bull, a pint of Stella and a torn-up beer mat in front of her. Ian was a selfish, thoughtless prick. She'd been fixing her makeup 40 minutes ago in her flat when the phone went. He was cancelling on her. Wasn't the first time either. Claimed he had to work on at the paper. Didn't mention Rose, but he didn't need to. She had suspicions, but she didn't want to be that girlfriend, accusing and paranoid. What was it Kurt sang? Just because you're paranoid don't mean they're not after you. Or in her case, just because she was paranoid didn't mean Ian wasn't fucking that big-titted bitch behind her back. So, fuck him. She had come out on her own. None of her flatmates were around, and there was no point asking Gordon and Sam. They never went out anymore. She pulled the two tickets from her jacket pocket. DF Concerts presents Afghan Wigs plus special guests at the venue, Edinburgh, Thursday the 4th of June, doors 8 p.m, ticket £5 plus booking fee. She looked at her watch, then glugged her pint. AC/DC on the jukebox, Highway to Hell. This was an old-school rock bar full of leather and tassels. Not her scene, but there was something honest about it. She gulped the rest of her pint and left. Outside, she sparked up a joint as she headed down to the venue. A whole joint in a oneer was too much for her, so she nipped it halfway, waited for it to cool, and stuck it in her pocket. Pulled out a wrap and dabbed speed on her gums. Ran her tongue round her mouth, sucked at her teeth. She headed inside, nodding at Big Ian on the door. It was hot and sweaty inside, already three quarters full. L7 were playing over the PA. She liked that an all-girl grunge band was getting somewhere, but if she was honest, she wasn't mad about their tunes.
She got a can of Red Stripe at the bar, better than risking the watered-down draught.
"Hello, gorgeous,"
she turned. "Johnny Lamb." She felt a buzz go through her. She'd met him twice in Soundgarden in February. After that first encounter, she teased Ian about never mentioning him, and Ian had clammed up. The times they'd met, it wasn't intentional. Ian apparently set on keeping them apart. When she kept on asking, he mumbled something about Johnny having a dark past, being unhinged, but he never elaborated, which only made her more interested. She looked at him now, wondering what secrets lay behind that curly fringe, those sharp blue eyes. She was glad Ian was working late at the paper. Tonight was going to be a good night. She raised her Red Stripe.
"Hello yourself."
He took the can from her hand and drank, handed it back.
"Thanks,"
he said.
"You cheeky shit, you owe me a drink."
"Fair enough." He leaned on the bar and got served straight away by a girl with a black flag tattoo on her arm. Cracked the two cans and handed one to Elaine.
"On your own,"
he said.
"Yeah, your brother bailed out last minute, had to work."
Johnny shook his head.
"He works too hard."
"Tell me about it."
"Very serious boy."
"Yeah," Elaine looked around.
"You with people?"
Johnny followed her gaze.
"I was," he said, waving vaguely.
"Shouldn't you get back to them?"
He threw a smile her way.
"They won't miss me. I'd rather stay here with you."
She knew what he was doing, and she let him, didn't close it down.
Why should she?
She nodded her head towards a dark corner and walked. He followed. She liked the simplicity of that, the power of having a man in her control. She pulled the speed wrap from her pocket and held it out.
"Want some?"
He smiled again. He was full of smiles. She couldn't picture him doing anything crazy.
He took it from her.
"Don't mind if I do."
He unfolded the paper triangle and dabbed at the speed, three quick movements, his tongue flicking in and out.
"I owe you now," he said.
"You don't owe me anything."
He held out his hand.
"Here."
Two pills.
Ecstasy.
"I've never taken E before," she said.
He raised his eyebrows.
"There's a first time for everything."
She looked round at the crowd waiting for the band to come on. The Lemonheads were playing over the PA, not My Drug Buddy, that would be too perfect. Stove, from the album before, about getting a new stove and missing the old one. Except it wasn't about stoves at all. She took the pill and placed it on her tongue, washed it down with a swig of Red Stripe. He grinned and threw the other pill into his mouth, then held his beer up to her.
"Here's to a good night," he said.
Afghan wigs were so different from the other bands kicking around. For a start, they wore suits and had short hair. They just seemed grown up, like men amongst the angsty boys of grunge. Greg Dulley's concerns were a league above the teenage troubles of Soundgarden. And they had soul. They played a Prince song, covered Heatwave, then for an encore did a heartbreaking version of Band of Gold. Elaine soaked all this up as the waves of euphoria swept over her. She knew it was chemically induced, but so what? Weren't all emotions just chemical reactions in the brain? Johnny smiled at her as the band left the stage.
"Amazing," he said.
"Yeah." He was talking about the band, but maybe something else too. She wanted him to be talking about her. She wasn't angry at Ian anymore. He just wasn't a concern. She couldn't see how he could feature in her future. Johnny, on the other hand. She leaned in, grabbed his hair, and kissed him hard. He kissed her back. By the time they staggered out, it was getting light. The pill buzz had died down, but Elaine still had a warm glow in her stomach. They were arm in arm, laughing at nothing. She sparked up the half-joint, took a deep drag and passed it to him. Waverley Station was closed, so they couldn't cut through. Instead,
They headed down Carlton Road, then up New Street. Halfway up the road, there was a turn off into a derelict car park. Elaine grabbed Johnny and pulled him that way, into the muddy half-light. They were right next to the train tracks here, just over a flimsy mesh fence, the car park overlooked by East Market Street to their left. Above, towering over everything, the arches of Northbridge. She pulled him into a dark corner under one of the arches, the flap of pigeon wings far above. She was giggling as she kissed him. He responded. She pulled him close, stumbled backwards till she felt her back against the stone wall. She grabbed his arse and felt his cock hard against his jeans. She ran her hand under his T-shirt, felt his muscles. Felt herself getting wet already. His hand was on her breast. She took it and slid it down to her crotch, then moved it up and down till he got the idea. She pulled at her own belt and unbuttoned her jeans, and he slid his hand inside her pants. She grabbed at his trousers and undid them, pushed them down past his skinny arse, felt his cock press against her, took it in her hand and stroked it a few times, then pushed her hips away from the wall and slid her own jeans down to her knees. She took his cock and guided it inside her, pulled back from kissing to look at his face. He was smiling, a simple, cute smile. He started fucking her, slowly at first, then faster, both of them still looking in each other's eyes. This wasn't a drunken mistake. This was real, something she didn't have with Ian. She was close to coming. She wanted the release of it, the celebration of it. She felt it sweep from her crotch through her body, her legs shaky, her back arched, her mind empty. Then she felt him come inside her, his body rigid, breath held, eyelids flickering. She dug her nails into his buttocks and he shivered and placed his lips on her neck. "Wow," she said, out of breath. "That's one way of putting it." She laughed. She ran a hand through his hair and looked over his shoulder. The glass roof of Waverley Station shimmered in the pre-dawn light. Above, the shape of North Bridge dwarfed everything. They walked up the Royal Mile and South Bridge, past kebab shops and chippies, drunks drifting home. They didn't talk about what had just happened. Elaine rested her head on his shoulder as they walked. They turned into West Nicholson Street and stopped. Ian was sitting in the doorway of Avalanche Records, next door to Elaine's flat. He had a bag of chips open on his lap, but he looked asleep. Johnny turned to her. "I'd better go." "Yeah." "Fancy meeting you two here," Ian said, trying to push himself onto his feet. He was drunk. "Want a chip?" Elaine looked at Johnny. Ian did the same. "What are you doing here?"
"Just walking Elaine home," Johnny said. Ian looked confused.
"How noble of you. I meant, why are you with my girlfriend?"
Johnny tilted his head.
"We met at the gig, the one you bailed from." "Ian, what are you doing here?"
Elaine said.
"Came to find you," Ian said. "Work went on later than expected." "But you had time to get drunk after."
"I didn't know where you were after the gig. The guys from the paper were heading for a wee nightcap, so I went along."
"Was Rose there?"
"Of course. She's part of the team."
Elaine imagined she could smell Rose's perfume on him. But then, what could Ian smell on her?
"Go home, Ian." He frowned. "But I want to speak to you."
Elaine shook her head.
"Not like this."
She got keys out her pocket and headed for her door.
"Give me a call tomorrow, if you remember."
She turned to Johnny.
"Thanks for walking me home."
"My pleasure," he said. She went inside, her heart racing, and left the brothers behind her.
Chapter 39. Martha felt Billy pressing gently against her arse. Morning glory and all that. They were in Ian's bed. Vague sunlight bled through the curtains. Billy was spooning her, his hand on her upper arm, his breath on her back. She pushed her arse against him.
a signal. She pulled her pants down and reached behind to stroke his buttock. He got the message. She felt him slip inside her and move slowly in and out. She did likewise. She was still half asleep. Tried to remember last night. Had they? They were now, anyway. Billy's hand had slid down and was playing with her. She felt a warmth spreading over her as they moved in time, in rhythm. It felt good. Better than good. It felt like being home. Billy kissed her back, her neck. She tried not to think of her house, burnt to the ground. Tried not to think of her dad lying on platform 8. Tried not to think of Gordon's missing face. Tried not to think of Johnny Lamb. She wasn't going to come. Billy was. She felt him come inside her and she wriggled her arse in circular motions, the warmth still spreading through her body, but not quite there. Next time, maybe. She turned to face him. Wow, he said. She smiled, kissed him on the lips. We need to get going, she said. Chapter 40. The smell was the worst thing. Somehow the sight of her home in ruins didn't hit Martha as much as the stench of the place, a charred oblivion that caught in her throat and made her gag. Wet charcoal mixed in with something nastier, the reek of smouldering man-made materials, melted plastics and fibres. There were no wispy smoke trails bleeding up into the sky, just an oppressive blanket of slush-grey cloud reaching down from above, spread over everything, keeping the stink in. A thin stretch of police tape was strung across the front path. When had the police been here? Martha lifted it and went under, Billy and Cal behind her, all of them silent. Her eyes were wet. From the fumes. Or maybe not. The roof was a wreck. Black marks stretched upwards from every window frame, from the front door as well, the ghost of the flames that had reached for the sky. No one else was around. Martha went to the front door and stepped inside. She felt tears in her face and wiped them away. She never thought she would care about bricks and doors and windows, but this was too much. The walls in the hall were black except for a few corners where the wallpaper had only bubbled and blistered. Into the living room. Burnt-out sofas and a charred television with a cracked screen. Melted cables running out the back. The area where the gas fire had been was just blackened space. She tried to remember. The blanket. Ian's notebook. The fake coal fire. Her shivering. Finding out about Johnny and leaving in a hurry. She turned away. Cal and Billy stood behind her. Cal wrapped her in a hug as she felt her body shudder with sobs. It'll be okay, he said. The insurance will pay for everything. She sniffed and wiped at her eyes with the backs of her hands. Will they? Of course, that's what insurance companies are for. Martha pulled away from him, went over to the window frame and looked out. From here, the garden looked normal. If she angled her head just right, she could pretend none of this had happened. An edge of glass clung to the frame. She pressed her hand against it until a spot of blood appeared. She pressed some more. Eventually, she raised her hand to her mouth and sucked at the blood. All she could taste was charred wood from the window frame. She turned back to Billy and Cal. "I'm going to find Johnny Lamb," she said. "You coming?" Chapter 41. Martha paid the taxi driver and followed Billy out the cab. Outside the Andrew Duncan Clinic at the Royal again. Was it just yesterday she'd been here for ECT? Short-term memory, blah. She looked round but didn't know where to start. There was no obvious reception area to the hospital. The place seemed to have grown like a commune. Lots of little self-interested departments. No overarching structure. So she went to the place she knew. "You okay?" Billy said. Cal was on opening shift at the basement again. Before he left, he told Billy to look out for Martha. She was insulted.
"I'm fine," she said. "Come on."
She headed into the building, turned towards the ECT room, Billy behind her. Got there. Lights off, door locked.
Shit!
Turned and retraced her steps to the exit of recovery room 2. Locked. She squinted her mouth. She headed back along the corridor, stopped at the entrance to a cafe and looked inside. Formica tables, plastic chairs, cheap coffee machine. Pockets of relatives, patients and staff all hunkered down against the early morning. She spotted her. Got lucky. Colleen, the Irish nurse. She walked over, Billy still traipsing behind her. Pulled up a seat opposite the nurse, Billy did likewise. Colleen looked up from the Now magazine she was flicking through, raised her eyebrows and smiled.
"It's yourself," she said. "How are you keeping?"
"I'm fine," Colleen frowned.
"You don't have an appointment today, do you? I've nothing in the book."
Martha shook her head. "It's not that." She reached over and took Colleen's hand, looked her in the eye, tried to put on her most serious face. "I need your help."
"Oh, I really shouldn't be doing this."
"I know," Martha said. "I appreciate it. If I got found out, I could get in a lot of trouble. I wouldn't ask if I didn't really need to know." Colleen tapped away at the keyboard, sifting through the hospital's filing system on the screen. A few clicks, some more typing into boxes. Martha looked at the screen but couldn't make sense of the spreadsheet gibberish.
"John Lamb, you say?"
Martha nodded. "That's right."
"Do you have a date of birth?"
"No.
Wait, yes. They were twins. 13th of February, let me think of the year."
She worked backwards in her head.
1970, I think."
More tapping on the keyboard. Martha sensed Billy to her left and wondered what he made of all this. The ECT, the house fire, the missing uncle.
"Found him," Colleen said.
Martha leaned in to examine the screen. She wanted a picture of him, visual evidence that Johnny Lamb existed, but of course the screen was just full of database information, patient reference numbers, doctor's notes.
"It seems he's no longer with us," Colleen said.
"You mean dead?" Martha said. Colleen shook her head quickly.
"No, no. I mean not a patient at the Royal anymore."
"But he was sent here from Carstairs, wasn't he?"
"Oh, yes, but he was only here for 6 weeks, it looks like."
"So where is he now?" Colleen ran a finger along the screen, checking the details. She squinted at the small typeface.
"He was released into the care of Ian Lamb," she said. "That ring any bells?"
Martha and Billy shared a look.
"Yes," Martha said. "My dad."
"Sure, I have an address here. 42 Drummond Street."
"The flat."
Martha couldn't get her head round it.
"And when was he released?"
Colleen raised a finger to the screen again.
"Says here it was the 14th of March, so what's that, 20 days ago?"
"Is that the last information you have for him?" Billy asked. "No outpatient visits or anything?" Colleen checked.
"He was due for a meeting with the consultant last week, but it looks like he didn't show up."
"Isn't there some sort of protocol for that? Shouldn't the police be informed?" Colleen looked at him.
"This isn't a prison, son. It's a hospital. If he was signed out of here, then he was judged fit to re-enter society. If he missed an appointment, there's not much we can do."
Martha was shaking her head.
"Christ."
"Are we done now?" Colleen said. "I'd like to shut this down. I don't want to get in any bother." Martha rubbed at her temple, trying to think.
"Yes, of course. Thanks so much, Colleen." "You're welcome, pet. Try to take it easy, eh?"
"Yeah, I will," Martha said.
"So what now?"
Billy said.
Martha shook her head again. "I have no idea."
Colleen's finger was hovering over the mouse as she frowned at the screen.
"There is one more note on his file," she said.
Martha turned.
"Yeah?" There's mention of an information request pending.
Billy shrugged. What does that mean?
The hospital has to release non-confidential patient information under the Freedom of Information Act if we get an inquiry. We had a request in writing on March the 18th and still awaiting a reply.
The day after Ian died.
Martha's eyes widened.
Who from?
Rose Brown.
Colleen looked up from the screen.
Mean anything to either of you?
Chapter 42.
Billy held the door open for Martha as they strode out the building. No answer on her mobile either, Billy said.
Try her flat again, Martha said.
Billy pressed the buttons as he walked, put the phone to his ear. They were across the overcrowded car park when he shook his head.
Straight to voicemail.
They walked fast out the hospital entrance, heading for Morningside Road through the neat rows of Victorian sandstone terraces. Posh neighbourhood. Martha wondered what they thought of having a loony bin next door.
What about the office?
Just phoned. She's meant to be on shift but hasn't turned up.
Shit, Martha said. We need to find her.
Martha flagged a cab on the main road and they jumped in.
Take us to the Regent Bar in Abbey Hill, Billy said.
Martha looked at him.
The gay pub?
It's the easiest direction to give. Her flat is right upstairs. Morningside Road was slow going. An old dear in front of them was making a hash of trying to park outside a little gift shop, holding everyone up.
Fuck's sake, said the driver.
Martha turned to Billy.
So, you're the ex-crime reporter. What are we thinking here?
What are you thinking? Billy said. It's your story. Martha pinched the bridge of her nose, then spread her hands out wide, inviting ideas.
Okay. Johnny was switched from Carstairs to the Royal a couple of months ago. After only a few weeks, he was signed out by Ian, 3 days before Ian jumped off North Bridge. We don't know where Johnny is.
And we don't know where Rose is, Billy said.
Correct.
Martha sucked her teeth.
Gordon knew Ian and knew that Ian had a twin brother. Do we think Gordon knew Johnny as well?
No idea.
And what about Rose? Martha said. Why should she be asking about Johnny?
She knew Ian from way back, Billy said. Maybe she knew Johnny too. A silence between them.
Okay, let's rewind a bit. Johnny spent, what, 21 years in Carstairs?
What for?
That wee article in the newspaper only said a disturbance on North Bridge. Must have been some disturbance to warrant that sentence.
Billy shook his head.
They don't get a prescribed sentence, not at Carstairs. They're just kept there indefinitely until the doctors and whoever else think they're no longer a threat to society.
So, I guess good or bad behaviour while you're there makes a massive difference.
As would the response from family members outside, maybe.
Are you saying Ian might have had a reason to keep Johnny locked up? What would that be?
And why would that reason suddenly change a couple of months ago, Billy said, after so many years?
Martha sighed.
Where does Rose fit into all this?
No idea.
And what about Elaine?
Billy just shrugged.
Their taxi was heading through the meadows now, past a bunch of students playing frisbee. Martha tried to remember a time when she was just a carefree student mucking around in a park with her friends.
We really have no idea what the hell's going on, do we?
She said.
Chapter 43. Martha watched Billy pay the driver this time. This wild goose chase was costing them a fortune in cab fares. They got out at the Regent and Billy fished his keys out of his pocket. It was only then Martha remembered he lived with Rose. Strange setup.
Rose has some questions to answer, she said.
Billy gave her a look.
Let's just wait and see what she has to say for herself. I'm sure it'll all add up.
In the front door, then up the stairs to the third floor. Into the flat. Billy stepped over a couple of letters on the floor behind the letterbox.
Rose?
No answer. They headed through to the living room.
Nice flat. Newly sanded floorboards, high ceilings, tasteful bookshelves in distressed white. There was a beautiful view over to Salisbury Crags out the bay window. Must have been a great place to see them in flames the night Billy was up there. Through into the kitchen, equally tasteful. Marble work surfaces, a classy cooker and utensil rack.
Rose!
Nothing. Then they heard a soft thump. Back out and down the hall to the other end of the flat, Rose's bedroom, the door was closed. Billy knocked. Rose, are you okay? No answer. Martha looked at him, raised her eyebrows. Billy pushed the door open. Rose was lying on a double bed in silky maroon underwear. The sheets were ruffled around her as if she'd been restless in her sleep. There was a small pool of vomit on the pillow next to her head and a thin sliver of drool webbed from the corner of her mouth to it. Martha saw a laptop open on the bed beyond her, but couldn't see the screen from here. There was an empty bottle of gin on the floor, and Rose's hand was hanging over the side of the bed above it. That had been the noise, the sound of the bottle hitting the floor. On the bedside table was an empty bottle of prescription pills, the lid lying neatly next to the bottle.
Fuck, Billy said. Rose!
He went to her and shook her. Rose! He sat her upright. Her head lolled to the side like a puppet with the strings cut. Totally out of it. Her breasts almost hanging out of her bra. Martha pulled her mobile out and dialed 999.
This is total bullshit, Rose, Billy said. This is not you.
He shook her again, then tried to prise an eyelid open. The eye was rolled right back, just the white showing. He put his ear to her mouth, then felt her neck for a pulse.
She's still alive, he said. She's breathing.
Martha told the woman on the phone they needed an ambulance, told them the address, what had happened. She got put through to someone who asked what Rose had taken. A bottle of gin and a bottle of pills.
What are the pills?
She went over to the bedside table and lifted the bottle. Xanax. The prescription on the bottle was made out to Ms. R. Brown. They told her just to stay calm, they'd be there as soon as possible, and Martha hung up.
What did they say? Billy said.
To hang on till the ambulance arrives.
Is that it?
It'll be here in a few minutes, Martha said. This was like the last time, with Gordon, all over again.
We can't just sit here.
What do you suggest? We've got to empty our stomach.
You sure?
You've seen it on the television enough, help me. They took an arm each and tried to walk her up and down the hall, but her feet dragged behind her.
Come on, Billy said. Fuck's sake, wake up, you can't do this, understand?
It wasn't working. They walked her into the bathroom, to the sink, bent her over, and Billy stuck two fingers down her throat. Martha's gag reflexes worked at the thought of it as Billy continued, removing his fingers and pushing them in again between Rose's pale lips.
Is that a good idea? Martha said. I've got to do something.
Just then, Billy's hand was swamped in vomit as Rose puked all over the sink and floor. Her throat spasmed as the puke was replaced by yellow bile. Martha saw undigested pills amongst the watery mess and wondered how many she'd taken. Billy whispered in Rose's ear.
Come on, wake up. Stay with us.
The buzzer went and Martha bolted to the door. Two paramedics came in and hustled through to the bathroom, asking questions in steady voices. Martha showed one of them the pill bottle while the other spoke to Rose, easing her onto a stretcher and examining her.
Let's move her, he said, placing an oxygen mask over her mouth.
They lifted the stretcher and their bags of equipment and headed for the door, Billy following them. Martha headed for the bedroom.
I'll see ye down there.
She ran and scooped up the laptop from Rose's bed, shuggled the touchpad to wake it up, but it was password protected. She closed the screen and popped the laptop into her bag, then left the flat. Downstairs, they were getting the stretcher into the back of the ambulance, punters in the region ogling out the window at the activity. Martha followed Billy into the ambulance. Their second ride in the back of an ambulance this week. Chapter 44. This time, they had a legitimate reason to be in the ICU. It was the same nurse from before when they'd blagged in to see Gordon.
She gave them a funny look, as if they were cursed. Who goes to see two unrelated people in intensive care in the space of a couple of days? Maybe the nurse was right, Martha thought. Maybe she was the Grim Reaper, bringing death to all those who came near. She would have laughed at the idea if it didn't have a ring of awful truth about it. But Rose wasn't dead. Not yet, anyway. The nurse buzzed them through, throwing them a scowl. Martha wondered if Rose would be in the same bed, the one Gordon had died in. The death bed. That would be a sign, wouldn't it? A sign that Martha was a harbinger of doom. But it wasn't the same bed. Her room was further along, on the other side of the corridor. Fate was never that neat. There was a cop by Rose's bedside, not a PC Plod, someone higher up, judging by the stripes and the uniform. Hair greying at the sides, distinguished but hangdog, his face tripping him. He was staring at Rose, laid out on the bed, white sheets over her body. She seemed somehow diminished, like she'd shrunk. Her face was a patchy grey, red blotches on her cheeks. Maybe the toxins were trying to leach out. There had been stomach pumping at A&E and a few injections. Martha didn't know what of. Lots of doctor chat about anti-this and hemo-that. Some mention of adrenaline. Martha had plenty of that to spare. In the end, they said Rose was stable but in a coma. Same as Gordon. Although the A&E doctor, a woman not much older than Martha, said Rose had a good chance of recovery. The coma was probably just the body shutting down to repair itself, rather than powering down for good. "Stuart," Billy said. The cop turned, saw Billy, turned back, shook his head. Billy put a hand on the cop's shoulder. "I'm so sorry," he said. The cop sighed. "You found her?" Billy nodded. "This isn't right," the cop said. Billy indicated Martha. "Stuart, this is Martha. She works at the paper." Martha didn't speak. What could she say? Nothing was appropriate for a man sitting by the bed of an attempted suicide in a coma. She knew that from bitter experience. "Martha, this is Stuart, D.I. Price, Rose's..." He didn't need to say who this man was to Rose. It was obvious. "Describe the scene for me," Stuart said. "Are you sure?" Stuart nodded. Billy ran through it, the booze, the pills, Rose on the bed. Seemed more normal in the retelling, less life and death somehow, just another everyday suicide attempt. Stuart rubbed at his temple. "Doesn't make sense." "I know," Billy said. "This isn't like Rose at all." Billy just nodded. Martha supposed there was a limit to the number of times you could say, "I know." And their job wasn't to fill the space. It was to let Stuart talk it out. Martha remembered something. "The laptop." "What?" Stuart said. "Rose's laptop was open on the bed as if she'd been working on it." Billy's eyebrows were raised. "That's right. I forgot about it in all the madness." Stuart's eyes widened. "We need to get that laptop right now." Martha undid the buckles in her bag and pulled it out. "I picked it up. Thought it might be useful." Stuart and Billy gave each other a look that made Martha feel good. "But it's password protected." She opened it up. "Any ideas?" Billy nodded. "I know it. Jean Genie." Stuart nodded. Billy took the laptop and typed in the password. The screen lit up and they all stared at it. An open Word document, a few lines typed. "I'm sorry. For a long time I have kept a secret. There are terrible things in my past, things I shouldn't have done, things I feel so guilty about. I have wronged someone so badly, and I have taken away the best years of his life as a result. I don't want sympathy. I am a bad person. I can't live with what I've done. Sorry to everyone I've hurt. Goodbye." "Christ," Stuart said. "Rose didn't write that," Billy said. Stuart looked at him. "What?" Billy pointed at the screen. "She would never make that mistake. T-H-E-I-R instead of T-H-E-R-E.
Stuart narrowed his eyes. Not even drunken on pills?
Billy's mouth was a thin line.
Trust me, Rose would not make that mistake.
So someone else wrote this, Stuart said.
Johnny, Martha said.
Who?
She told him everything. Started with her dad's suicide, her first day in the office, Gordon's call, Ian's journal, Carstairs, the Royal Edinburgh, and now Rose. All apparently linked by one thing. Johnny Lamb.
But why would he be behind this? Stuart said.
Good question, Billy said. We tried to get a look at the court report of the incident we found in the paper all those years ago, but the reports that far back are archived. We have to wait a week to hear anything.
Stuart nodded.
I'll get it sooner, and I'll dig out the police file as soon as I'm back in the office. We need to find this guy.
That's what we've been trying to do, Martha said.
What's the last known address?
Martha shook her head.
Drummond Street, but he's not staying there.
How do you know?
Because I'm staying there.
Since our house burnt down, Billy said.
Stuart scratched at the back of his hand and stared at Martha.
Your house burnt down?
Yeah.
An accident?
Martha shrugged.
I don't know.
Billy closed the laptop.
You think Johnny might have had something to do with that?
That had never occurred to Martha. She'd presumed it had been her. The blanket, the fireplace, short-term memory loss.
But maybe she hadn't destroyed her home after all.
Stuart frowned.
It's my job to investigate things, keep all possibilities open.
He stood up, leaned over the bed and kissed Rose on the forehead.
I'll be back soon, love.
He turned to Martha and Billy.
I'll be in touch, he said, then walked out the room.
Martha looked at Rose. Her skin was oily, like she was encased in a sheen of poison. Martha thought back to their meeting outside the hospital when she came to see Gordon. Rose had said that Martha reminded her of herself when she was young. She wondered if this fate awaited her when she was older. But she wasn't going to reach 50, lying in a hospital bed in a coma, tubes leading out of her. She had a sudden, overwhelming feeling she was going to die soon. Chapter 45. It didn't feel right being back in the office. She should be out searching for Johnny, not cutting and pasting, writing picture captions. But she had to keep in with the paper, had to keep reminding herself this was her big break, foot in the door and all that. And anyway, she had no idea where to begin looking for Johnny. That was the sad truth.
How you doing, Fluke? V said.
News of Rose had spread around the office already. Of course, why wouldn't it? There was genuine concern on V's face. Martha wanted to explain, but really, what did she know for certain? People were suddenly killing themselves around her. Maybe that's all there was to it. Maybe this whole Johnny Lamb thing was in her head. She needed a bogeyman to pin everything on, to take away from the awful realisation that some people just can't handle it and want to end it all. She had a splitting headache. She wondered about the ECT, if it was a delayed side effect.
I'm fine,
she finally said. She dug some cocodamol out her bag. V handed her a protein shake to wash them down. She took it and glugged. Horrible.
Anything I can do, sweetheart? V said.
Martha shook her head.
I guess we just have to get on with shit, huh?
Martha shrugged.
Yeah, get on with things.
Just keep putting one foot in front of the other and hope you don't walk straight into an open grave waiting for your sad and lonely little body. Just keep breathing and walking and talking and try not to accidentally shoot yourself in the face or jump off a high bridge or take a whole bottle of pills or slit your wrists or jump in front of a train or stab yourself in the heart over and over again until there was nothing left but meaty mush. Just get on with it. She looked at the pile of stuff in her desk. V had helped, printing out likely targets for commissioning out obits over the next few days, making a note of people to call and chat to, freelancers to chase up, one piece of syndicated copy from the States to be edited and laid out on the page.
Truth be told, V had done most of it already, just one or two smaller pieces to write. That was up to Martha, mopping up the minnows, writing about the people no one else